Sometimes it's easy to lose the thread, especially when we are reading stories that are familiar but are part of the larger narrative. Think about the sort of the little bits of progress and process that we all know is as part of the wilderness experience in the Old Testament. They might be in our head somewhere, but to know them as, well, this was chapter 6 of the story versus chapter 10, not so much. And we had the same in the new, in the shape of, as things progress with Jesus, we have things in the different Gospels, in the different places, but also stories that we know are part of the progress, but don't quite place themselves outside of this. And I think this is one of those stories. This is a Jerusalem story leading up to the Passion, leading up to the cleansing of the temple in Luke, leading up to what we come next. And it's part of this process. This is Luke chapter 20, verses 27 through 40. Some Sadducees, those who say that there is no resurrection, came to him and asked him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother died, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were 7 brothers. The first married and died childless, then the second, then the third, and the third married her, and so on. In the same way, all 7 died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the 7 had married her. Jesus said to them, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in the age and in the resurrection from the dead either marry or are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and children of God, being children of the resurrection. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed in the story about the bush, where he speaks about the Lord as the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Now he is God, not of the dead, but of the living, for to him all are alive. Then some of the scribes answered, teacher, you have answered well. For they no longer dared to ask him any other questions. Our calendar has a particular focus right now. It seems like this is the season where we spend a lot of time looking into the dark. Perhaps it's the unavoidable magnetism that we have that comes with the changing of the seasons, clocks and all the rest, as we in the Northern Hemisphere know the inescapable progression into the physical darkness of winter. Or maybe it's just what you do when you realize that you are on the downslope of yet another year. You remember what has been and get ready to celebrate. Because right now, that's what we're doing a lot of. We're thinking about the other. And the first occasion is obvious. How for all its candy-covered goodness and good-natured intent, at least in its current form, ask the fundamental question, what's out there in the universe that we don't fully understand and control? Then comes All Souls Day. This is All Souls Sunday of the Higher Church. And it's Latin, Latino connected ancillary, Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, where you think about those who have come before and remember and hold them dear. I actually came to really appreciate Dia de los Muertos living in Tucson, where there was a large public parade with everyone holding a picture of someone who they loved and both celebrating and grieving in public. That's unique. But we're not yet done. Then comes Veterans Day later this week, more widely known in allied countries as Remembrance Day. Remembering the cost of war and honoring those who borne the terrible bill, connecting us to the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, when the armistice of the first war to end all wars stopped the slaughter of millions. This date, coincidentally, was not accidentally chosen. November 11th is the feast day for St. Martin of Tours, the patron saint of soldiers. I find it interesting that we connect a day of peace to a day of soldiers and to a saint who's one of whose remarkable happenings was laying down his arms as he had said to Christ. So the patron saint of soldiers is indeed one of the Christian pacifists of the first generation. Even Thanksgiving invites us to look back in gratitude for what has been and revering what might come before. Memory and remembering are so much on our minds right now, and it's rightly so. Because, like I say, it is something that we do. It's something in the air, and it's good. And maybe we just need to do that before we get started with the celebration of newness and otherness that we find in Christmas and New Year's. Perhaps it's allowing ourselves to know what we have lost before we can then pick up what we might find. And we know that this is something that we do. We grieve. We all grieve. Just because we are a people who are drawn to sing boldly and fully, O death, where is thy sting? As the ultimate reality. That does not mean that we do not feel that sting in the distinct losses of our lives. What are we to do with our grief when our theology would seem to steer us away from this? In this story this morning, I wouldn't blame you if you have encountered this story and just sort of discounted it as, well, we are into angels dancing on the heads of pins territory. The stuff that we ask of God and about God that doesn't really have all that much relevance to what is here. Yet there's something going on here that is important for us and in the ministry of Jesus. First, as I noted initially, this is one of these culminating stories. It's something that progresses towards something, and it's a question and a notion that is asked with a purpose. This interaction is one in a series, each one designed by the seeker to demonstrate how Jesus violates the laws beyond the pale. The Pharisees and Sadducees, sets of the priestly hierarchy, who were mostly in opposition to each other, were united in their suspicion and plotting against Jesus and what they might mean for them. This whole chapter recounts the various quizzing of Jesus as he taught in the temple, which he had acted against his days before, throwing out the money changers and those selling sacrifices. It is here that we have the high stakes game of Jeopardy concerning the paying of taxes, the true identity of John the Baptist, and any number of other hot button issues designed to be Jesus' undoing in every turn. And this is no different. They're trying to ensnare Jesus by putting him up against the categories that they knew and they understood. The Sadducees, as we're told, were those who didn't believe in the resurrection. And the reason why they didn't believe that is mainly it wasn't part of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. The Sadducees, one of their basic reasons for being was saying, okay, the best way to be Jewish is to follow the core of the law, the core of our identity, which is Moses. And so when they say, well, if Moses didn't say it, then it must not be real. We then understand why it was important for Jesus to answer in terms of Moses, in terms that they could hear. And they were asking a valid question, because Deuteronomy states very clearly, as they say, this is what you do in this case. When there is no child to carry on the family name, the brother can marry and do that on behalf of his brother. And so on and so on. And if you didn't do that, by the way, there was a provision that if the brother didn't want to marry his sister-in-law, the sister-in-law could go before the elders and say, this isn't working. And the elders would talk with the person, and if he persisted, the sister-in-law was then entitled to shame the brother before the whole community, spitting in his face and removing his shoe along the way. Basically saying, you are not worthy to be part of the congregation anymore. So this isn't just an idle hypothetical here. It is, okay, how does the law work when things get complicated? And if there is a resurrection, as you say, what do we do with all that? But Jesus' answer has to do far more with just sorting out the machinations of who marries who in the afterlife. Instead, Jesus reframes the issue entirely. What is being dealt with here is not the workings of the world as we know it, but the world that is beyond the considerations of law and duty and honor. The nature of resurrection, the nature of the new life that is received is so different, so new, so other, that one cannot carry over the rules of one age to the next. The translation itself is beyond the imagination that we have, Jesus suggests, and it doesn't bear holding on to. God, Jesus says, is ever creating, ever creative and ever living, as the God of Yahweh, God of Israel. And this God does not deal with the dead or the ways of the world creates again a new world, a new reality, a new hope, which is beyond the very categories and catch-alls of this world. God is the God of the living, whether it is in this world or the next. It is this life and this promise and this hope that the kingdom is all about. Life is there, and abundantly so, as it is here. But we're also called to live in faith, that that hope and that life and that reality is something that we find beyond ourselves. Life, be it present or future, is the domain of God, and there is hope for each, no matter where we find ourselves. And I think that that is an important part of what Jesus is saying here. But equally important is also what Jesus does not say as well. Specifically, he doesn't just dismiss the question and say, oh, seriously, come on. Instead, he engages it realistically and fully. He doesn't say that death is no big deal, or suggest that it should only be thought of as a means to an end, or something to be disregarded without grieving or a care. Let's remember that this was a teacher who wept at the grave of his friend, mourning the passing of one who he loved. Jesus is not saying that this is some sort of simplistic formulation of people lounging on clouds wearing angels' wings, but simply that resurrected life is one that is beyond the categorization and the prioritization of this world. And what I have applied my imagination to the next world, I'm always interested in the results. Because it's so hard. And just begin with a basic concept. There is no time. Can we imagine a universe where the temporal beings that we are no longer matters? And whatever the clock might have to say, the clock remains important. Even if we have to grumble every year to say, okay, we have to turn it back and forth. And around we go. Even in the great beyond, Jesus argues, we are met in something that is far greater than us. In the inspiring God that is the root of all. And all of this matters, because resurrection matters. But it might just not take the shapes that we think, that we expect. This may not be the answer that we seek, as we want the whole specification and exact description and of what comes next. But it does speak truth and invites new imagination of what's possible. And it's this imagination that Jesus is inviting his hearers into, and through them, us, to understand. The law was meant to regulate the world. Jesus has as much reverence and respect for the law as any of those who would try to entrap him within it, something which we are all rather good at. What makes Jesus the revolutionary and world-shaking character that he is not in his ability to set the law ablaze in its overturning, but simply his ability to reframe what is really important about the law and his ability to bridge the distance between the world as it is and the world as it will be. Jesus seems to see the anxieties and concerns that underlie these questions. He does not apply the law as a means of gaining leverage or ascending a moral high horse. Rather, his application of the law is oriented towards what is good and just and beneficial. The law is not a tool for our free disposal to use to construct and reconstruct the life as we know it. But it's meant to be a guide to enrich our daily life, inviting us into an imagination of what's possible and what we can celebrate, what's here and now. In this season of memory and of celebration, we can grieve. We can fully know what we have lost. But we're also invited to imagine completely, even beyond our imagination, that which lays before, where those who we have lost now reside, and where we, in time, will be embraced. Perhaps all that was ours will be returned to us, and fully so, even more than what we can ever imagine. Or perhaps the whole meaning of what is ours and what is theirs simply fades away, changes forevermore. We don't know what will be resurrected, what will be given new life, but we know God will be in it. But what I think will be left behind with the dead will be the bittering and the hypothesizing of this world. Not because it's bad, but simply because it will be something well beyond our world of care in that frame, and something that we can release because we will be with God, and our questions at last will have answers, or at least context. May the God of the living, in this world and the next, speak to us, invite us into resurrection, and embrace us in the end through the goodness of God. Amen.